Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. How are you doing tonight, Allison?
I'm doing okay. I'm very pleased that the temperature only had a tiny blip up into the 90s, and now we're back to the perfect weather of late May, which is my favorite time of year.
Yeah, that heat wave put me in a foul mood over the weekend.
It's like you could actually tell the minute it got to whatever arbitrary number it is that makes you an angry person. And you're not normally an angry person, but you became an angry person at whatever heat level that was.
We know, like, yeah. Chad and I pretty much have a standing date on Saturday nights. We go looking for spooky stuff.
To the sock hop and then out for shakes and malts and stuff. Whatever you do.
He texted me Saturday during the day and he's like, "What are you doing tonight?" And I was just,
being grumpy.
Yeah, sorry, Chad. I very grumpily texted back, "Nothing. I'm staying in. I hate this weather. I'm depressed." So Chad came over anyway, and we sat outside and had a nice discussion anyway. So that was very nice.
But now it's lovely.
Oh,
perfect,
yes.
May weather.
So much nicer now. So much nicer now.
Do you have a favorite time of the year? This is my absolute favorite time of the year.
Spring and fall. No. It used to be spring and fall. Now it's winter, honestly.
Really?
Maybe because of global warming, winter is more like fall used to be. I love winter. I love it. I know you don't like it. It's like kind of one of the things where we part ways in a major
way. It's not that I like summer. It's that I like sun. And not that I like to sit outside with like foil in front of my face, but I do need it for my own sanity's sake.
Yeah. And it's not that I like snow. It's that I dislike heat.
Yeah.
So heat is really, really bad for MS.
Where is it just perfectly like 70 degrees all the time, but sunny everywhere?
Yeah, I don't know.
And there aren't hurricanes,
Ireland,
tornadoes, nuclear power plants.
I don't know about that.
But I don't know. We're surrounded by all that stuff. We get all that stuff here and I still live here.
Let's move to Ireland.
Okay.
All right. You heard it, folks. Allison agreed. We're moving to Ireland. On tonight's show, we're going to be talking about a hermit priest.
This has a bit of outsider-ish kind of quality to it.
Yeah, I would definitely say he fits into the outsider art category.
That's something I feel like we could dive into a little bit more because there's so many great outsider artists that...
There really are. I think that would definitely fit within the general scope of Strange Familiars. Very interesting things to cover there.
Anytime anybody creates their own world, I think it's worthy of a supernatural paranormal podcast.
Yeah, Yeah, I'd agree. And this fella really did. And late in life.
You know? See, I like that. You know, like,
yeah,
it's like Julia Margaret Cameron was like 47 or 48 when her daughter gave her first camera.
Yeah, and not to give too much of the story away, but he was sort of forced into retirement. And for most people, that might have been it.
Mm-hmm.
But really, that's when the super interesting part of his life starts.
Mm-hmm.
Right then. It's a really, really interesting story.
Isn't that so often the case with, I mean, sort of a trope about adversity being the like the wellspring for creativity? But a lot of times it is. And it's not so much like you have to be super, super sad to do something creative. It's not that. But, you know, like if you're all of a sudden confined to, wasn't it like Matisse or someone who was, or Van Gogh, who was given a paint set upon being ill.
Mm.
And then that was the springboard for this amazing creative outlet.
Well, after my MS attack last year, I'm left with the fingers on my left hand are still numb. I can't play certain instruments anymore. And you're sort of given this choice, you know, do I stop making music or do I adapt and press on and figure out different and new ways to make music? You know,
and sometimes adaptation is really the path to innovation.
Limitations can be too,
because you think of like people who learn how to play guitar when they don't know the quote unquote correct way to play guitar. I can think of one of our friend's brothers who started playing flamenco guitar at a time when he had no clue how to play flamenco guitar.
Yeah, he developed his own style of playing. He got a flamenco sound. He didn't know how flamenco was played properly, and he developed his own style.
Yeah, and then when he learned how to play it properly into a, like a pretty much almost virtuoso level, whatever that uniqueness was there was to his initial...
Yeah, he lost that.
He lost that. He couldn't do it again because he had to do it the right way.
Some of my favorite albums were albums that I did when I placed limitations on the album. I'm only going to use one instrument, the Moth Mask album. I only used one banjo. Now, I played it umpteen different ways, and I sang through the head of the banjo, and I beat
it as a drum.
Like a drum, and bowed it with a violin bow, and sent it through effects pedals and everything else. But it was a really interesting thing, because it almost inspired creativity, the self-limiting aspect of it. It was like, well, now I have to get really creative, since I can only use this one instrument.
Yeah, it's kind of like Chopped, where you just, you know, you get your circus peanuts, your fish,
mm-hmm.
and your celery, and you have to make a decent meal out of it.
You got
to
get creative.
You got to be creative.
Well, before we talk about our hermit priest, I want to thank our patrons. Thank you so much, patrons. Thank you for what you do. We could not do Strange Familiars without you. You make Strange Familiars possible. There are 93 patron shows now.
Mm.
If you become a patron at Patreon, patreon.com/strangefamiliars, you get those 93 shows as soon as you sign up. And then we're doing two more full episodes of Strange Familiars just for our patrons every month. So you'll get two more for as long as you remain a patron every month. Check it out at patreon.com/strangefamiliars. Before we begin our story tonight, I want to say that we're going to do our best with the place names and the people names in this.
You had 2 years of Spanish in high school. I had some French in high school and college, but I was never good at it.
And this is Brittany anyway.
Which has a totally different dialect.
So. Yeah. So yeah, this is the places we will be talking about and the people we will be talking about are all from Brittany. We're going to do our best.
We know we're wrong. You can correct us, but it's not going to make my pronunciation any better.
We're trying to be respectful. I tried to look it up and see the proper pronunciation. I'm going to mess it up.
Yeah, we're going to mess it up. But.
So I'm pre-apologizing, and I'm throwing the articles at Allison to read, so she's probably going to have the bulk of the work here. The man we are talking about was known as Abbé Faury. He was a priest. So he settled in a place called Routeneuf. He retired there.
And this is on the coast?
This is on the northwest coast of Brittany. In 1894... a man appeared on the cliffs outside Routeneuf village. No one had ever seen him before. He was wearing a cassock. You know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
A long robe mm-hmm. that a priest would wear. And he was carving the rocks on the cliffs. And what he carved into those rocks was a number of different scenes. He was carving religious scenes, figures from folklore, medieval warriors, saints and angels, and a lot of what he was carving were scenes from the Rutenuf family. Obviously, the area is named for them. Now, that family has a very interesting history. They were a clan of smugglers and privateers, pirates, as we call them.
Oh, okay.
Fishermen and hunters. They ruled the coast of that part of Brittany for over a century. Really, really interesting family. And I guess there's sort of like stories that kind of went into the local folklore, and he carved some of their stories into the rock. So it was, you know, this local flavor that he was carving along with these, you know, more general kind of religious scenes.
And he didn't have like an ancestral tie to this area, per se.
One article mentions that he said that he was born there, but that's, as far as I know, that's not where he was born.
Yeah, I kind of looked it up because is it, like, his real name is what, like Adolphe Julien?
It was. Foray? It was. So this mysterious man was Abbé Fleury, and he was known as the Hermit of Rutenouf or the Hermit of the Rock. So here's what we know about the early life of Abbé Fleury. Adolphe Julien Fleury was born on September 4th, 1839, in Toul, Brittany. September 4th. He almost was born on my birthday. Mm-hmm. Or I guess I was almost born on his birthday. Yeah. According to an article printed in the Cincinnati Inquirer in 1903, he confided to the pastor of the village of Rutenouf that he was of noble birth. And that he had been jilted by a woman, which made him give up on mankind and led to him joining the priesthood.
Are we getting at our hermit bingo cards?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that a little bit, how this is a trope we hear again and again when it comes to hermits. There's always a woman that
jilted them, that
led them off. Sometimes it ends up being true. Yeah. Sometimes that really is the story with these guys. I don't know. By the time they were able to interview him, he had had some health problems, which we'll hear about.
But he was a priest, right? So the whole jilted lover story, like...
Well, they're saying that's what led him to
into the priesthood. Into the priesthood. Oh, okay.
Yes.
So, I mean, they're sort of equating priesthood and hermitdom as being very similar paths.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, to many, that stepping away from women, you know, from the chance at a wife or a romantic relationship in that sense, maybe it is... in a sense, equivalent to being a hermit.
Yeah, well, I mean, the path is that you're going to go it alone, whether it be with God or nature, I suppose, but not in sort of a stereotypical fashion.
Yeah.
With a partner.
Yeah, it would be interesting. We should probably make a chart of these different hermits and try to figure out which ones really were jilted by women, because the Wolf Hill Hermit in Gettysburg, that was supposedly part of his story, but we found out he was married a short time before he became a hermit, and his wife died. Mm-hmm. And some of the stories said he, you know, he had been jilted by a woman, blah, blah, blah. But some stories said his love interest had died. And we did find out that his wife did die shortly before then.
Some people are just too damn peculiar.
That's true. Abbé Fleury was ordained as a priest on December 19th, 1863.
Oh, so he wasn't that old.
No.
Only 24.
He spent his entire career as a priest in various villages throughout Brittany. From 1864 through 1877, he served as curate at Pampoon in the chapel of Saint, I'm going to use the Latin name, Saint Eligius of the Forges. They have the French name here. I'm just going to mess it up if I try it. Which is really interesting because here he supported a workers' movement, which led to the shutdown of blast furnaces in the region.
Like an early environmentalist kind of thing? Or was he just more that he was in support of the workers?
It was in support of the workers. They had just gotten the right to assemble, and he supported them. Some people said that this led into some of the controversy that may have pushed him into the retirement, but this is pretty early in his career. Some of the articles said like this was something that kind of upset his superiors because he got involved with these workers and like made him lose his position as a priest. But this is very early in his career. But I do think it's interesting that this fellow is involved with iron workers and iron furnaces here on Strange Familiars.
That's true. I also think it's interesting, too, because when we talk about one of the possible reasons that Nelson Reymeyer was targeted as a witch was not necessarily just because of his powwow beliefs, but also because he was a socialist,
yeah,
pro-labor.
It's a point that I really wanted to get into more when we did our first episode mm-hmm. on Hex Hollow. And my co-host at the time was very resistant to it. He thought I was being kind of trendy talking about socialism because Bernie Sanders was a big name at the time. And he thought that that was going to kind of
skew our politics one way or another.
Or it kind of become more the story mm-hmm. than what we had to tell. But
I think it's an integral part of the story.
There were powwow doctors all over York. Mm-hmm. And they weren't called demons, not even in the wake of this. You know, they weren't called black magicians. Mm-hmm. They weren't called witches, even in the wake of this, mm-hmm. the murder. But Nelson Reymeyer was. So it really does make me wonder if the issue wasn't so much that he was a powwow doctor, but more that he was politically different mm-hmm. than most of the folks around here. But we're not talking about Nelson Reymeyer tonight.
Okay.
In 1877, Abbé Ferré became the curate at Guipry, another town in Brittany. He was there until 1881, when he became the rector at Fourjoux-la-Forêt.
It means blacksmith of the forest.
Oh, really?
Or the forest smith.
Oh, that's cool. And he stayed there until 1887, when he became rector at Maxon. In 1889, he became rector at Longueuil.
This really is a like a trial by fire in French pronunciation.
Yeah. Records note that he arrived at Longueuil with, quote, hardness of ear, which I'm guessing means he was hard of hearing. Mm-hmm. He's beginning to lose his hearing at this point. So that's 1889.
So where he's starting the sort of Goya-esque transformation.
One could say, yeah, yeah. Now he has what they called a stroke, and I'm assuming it was a stroke.
It was a stroke, yeah.
That seemed to accelerate his hearing loss. Mm-hmm. And it also left him partially paralyzed.
Could he have had a brain tumor?
It could have been anything. I'm thinking they just called anything they didn't know a stroke back then.
Yeah, know? Like hearing loss with it?
Yeah. Whatever happened, it seemed to accelerate his hearing loss, and he's become partially paralyzed, which would get worse over the rest of his life.
Interesting.
Yeah. His parishioners drafted a petition requesting that Ferré be allowed to remain as their priest. However, his health and physical challenges forced him to leave his position. Abbé Ferré, he moved to what they called a hut at Routeneuf on the coast. And you would think this would be his retirement, but it was actually the beginning of his great work. Abbé Ferré had no artistic training before he started carving. So he moves to what they call a hut. And I don't know if it was a hut when he originally moved there, but by the time he was done with it, this was no hut. And he starts carving in wood, and he said he would see shapes in the wood. He would look at the wood and he would see faces or like mm-hmm. animal shapes. And he just used his penknife. He just used his pocket knife. He said he wasn't making the shapes, he was just making them clear. Like he was just kind of bringing the details out so other people could see what he was seeing.
Oh, wow. Wood.
He's supposedly I've seen some of his wood carvings and they're very, very cool. They're very neat.
Oh, yeah. I saw one that looked like almost like a freestanding. I don't know if it was like a fountain or it was definitely a religious scene that had that sort of look like a Station of the Cross or something, maybe. Mm. Really pretty and not at all amateurish.
No, no. In fact, we'll read an article in a bit where they kind of talk about how, I think they even use the word exquisite when they were talking about his wood carvings. It's like very intricate and beautifully done. So he had some skill for it, but he had never done it before. This was something he took up. He said he had free time. He went from wood to stone, and he eventually started carving the stone around his quote-unquote hut, and he moved on to the stone cliffs. And like so many other so-called outsider artists, he transformed his entire surroundings. And we were talking a little bit about this at the beginning of the show. He ends up surrounding his hut. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know if it was a hut truly when he moved there, if they're just saying this in articles to make him seem more hermit-like.
Yeah. But like, but how do you explain, like, sort of a dwelling of that kind to people who've never seen it before? It's always going to be kind of like a hut more than it is going to be a house proper.
I guess, but it looks like a pretty substantial stone house by the time he's done with it, including stone walls. They're almost like castle walls he's built around the place, complete with heads on the battlements. Like, he's got heads mounted on the battlements. Oh, wow. Like the carved heads, mm-hmm. You know, they're not real heads. This article, this is from the Wide World magazine from June 1909. A couple of people that went to visit Abbé Fauré, they end up getting an audience with him, which apparently was very rare at the time.
He wasn't one of those hermits that would come out and hang out with people.
At this point in his life, I think
his hearing was bad
and he was having trouble speaking and he was actually having trouble getting around. So it was rare to see him at this point. I think before, like if he got there at the right time, he was there. But in any case, there's a description of some of the carvings and stuff in this article I thought was really neat.
The following article relates the little-known life and work of one of the strangest characters to be found in the entire length and breadth of France. The Abbé Fauré, better known as the Hermit of Routeneuf, is enveloped in an atmosphere of mystery, and this fact, coupled with his celebrity as a sculptor of the granite cliffs near St. Malo, has made him a curious and prominent figure in his native district. The writer was accompanied on his visit to the hermit by M. Paul Jeannot, the well-known Parisian photographer, who succeeded in obtaining a unique portrait of the usually unapproachable abbé. The patron of the village inn of Routeneuf, which lies some 5 miles from St. Malo, on a wild and rocky coast, assured us, whilst we were sipping our café noir at the close of an excellent luncheon, that we should have a difficulty in seeing the hermit. Scores of messieurs les journalistes had come on the same quest and returned home disappointed. I'm told that a good deal depends on the state of the weather, continued our host, glancing out the window, and I must confess that it's in your favor today, but don't count upon it. The good abbé doesn't always respond to the sunshine and come out of his retreat. Who is the abbé? I inquired. How long has he been here, and whence did he come? Ah, monsieur, now you've asked me the usual posers. All I know is that he arrived here about 10 years ago, that he began to chip away at the cliffs, and that he's never left off chipping since. You'll learn no more in the village, though you question every one of the inhabitants. The landlord was right as regards the information to be gathered from the good people of Routeneuf. All that anyone could tell us was that the hermit had come among them quite mysteriously 10 years back, and that ever since he had lived almost the life of a recluse, his few wants being attended to by a faithful servant who, after long years of service, has become every bit as taciturn as her master. We decided, therefore, that the only thing to do was to try our luck, like the score or more of unsuccessful journalists who had preceded us. Without much hope of success, we at once set off for the western point of the bay. On the main road leading to that wild region we came across, the hermit's house, or as one ought perhaps to call it, fortress, for the only entrance is by way of the garden, through a doorway in a high, battlemented granite wall. But for the fact that the door was half open, and that the battlements were surrounded by a row of the most comical heads we had ever set eyes on, we should probably there and then have given up all idea of attempting to invade the privacy of the hermit. With those figures confronting us, however, how could we take the fortifications seriously? Drawing a little nearer, we discovered that these amusing grotesques were all of them neatly named, like objects in a museum. One of the central images, smiling at us from over the doorway, delighted in the name of Perino del Falaise. His companion to the right, a gentleman with an expression that denoted chronic dyspepsia, was Adolphe de la Haye, whilst the fierce-looking bonhomme to the left was Sieur de Hendal. Marc de Langlois was a jolly-faced monk with an imperial. Carl de la Villa Aura was undoubtedly a medieval warrior.
Thank you for doing that.
And the two dames, Yvonne de Mimpke and Jean de Lavord, were probably intended to represent types of feminine beauty during the Middle Ages. This remarkable gallery of portraits, which we rightly conjectured to be the work of the Abbé Fauré, was but an introduction, as we found on passing through the doorway into the garden, to even more extraordinary examples of his art. No one came forward to meet us as we entered, so we had ample opportunity to study the numerous heads in carved wood which stood here and there on pedestals and posts. The impression they produced was rather gruesome. Some were frowning, others were grinning, and others again displayed the lack of expression, always so painful to behold, which we find in the faces of the mentally deranged. One felt that there was something abnormal in the carved images of this strange silent garden. To dispel the feeling of oppression that was rapidly creeping over us, we moved toward the hermit's door and knocked. It was opened to us by an aged peasant woman, who in reply to our inquiries for her master informed us that though the monsieur was not then receiving visitors. I began to fear that the landlord of the inn was a true prophet. However, acting on the theory that hope still remained so long as the door was not actually closed in our faces, I kept up the conversation with the old housekeeper, expressing our regret that we could not learn something from the hermit's own lips about the remarkable pieces of sculpture which he had executed on the neighboring granite cliffs and which we had come hundreds of miles to see. Was it really impossible, I asked, to see him but for a few minutes? The woman hesitated, and you know the proverb concerning the woman who hesitates. Was it not 1,000 pieties, I continued eloquently, that one of us should have come all the way from England to see the celebrated sculptor of Rutenhof, only to find that he was not at home? This final argument evidently had considerable weight, for the aged dame, with a somewhat reluctant Jouret, returned into the house to consult her lord and master. Before she had taken many steps, however, who should come forward to meet her but the abbé himself? He was evidently almost stone deaf, for the servant had to shout out our message into his ear at the top of her voice. The word Angleterre seemed to produce an instant effect upon the hermit. They're British. He nodded and smiled, and then to our great satisfaction came towards us. The hermit has the appearance and manners of the typical old French priest. Deep lines mark his cheek and forehead, clearly denoting a great span of years during which his hardships have been anything but slight. His movements are extremely slow, due, as we afterwards learnt from his housekeeper, to partial paralysis. His hearing, as I have already mentioned, has almost gone, and his memory leaves much to be desired. Think of the difficulties of an interview under such circumstances as these. However, we succeeded in learning several interesting details about the life and work of this strange character, and these I will now set down. The abbé, formerly the curé of a village whose name no one has yet been able to discover, declares that he is 78 years of age. It is probable, however, that he is very much older, and that his mistake is due to his very defective memory. He is a native of Rutenhof, but nobody there can remember him as a child, so we are doubtless right in conjecturing that he left the village when in his youth and never returned to it until comparatively recent years. His object in returning was to spend his declining years in a district which he has held green in memory. As to his life during the interval of departure and return, it is enshrouded in mystery, the only fact which he seemed willing or able to impart being that he had spent part of his time in England as a teacher of French. Here, undoubtedly, was the explanation of the favor which he accorded us. On the subject of his work as a sculptor, the hermit was much more communicative. He gathered from his somewhat disjointed phrases that when he first began to carve in wood and stone, it was merely with the object of spending his leisure hours agreeably. But after a time, when he found that the public showed an interest in what he was doing, he thought that he might as well get some little profit out of his handiwork. Every laborer was worthy of his hire. His savings were small and barely sufficient to meet his needs, so where was the disgrace if he had turned a happy idea into current coin of the realm? His first efforts were in the direction of wood carving. Noticing that the knotty, twisted boles of trees sometimes strangely resembled human and animal forms, he began to make them still more lifelike by a dexterous cut here and there with his pocket knife. All his woodwork was carried out with an ordinary clasp knife. Whenever possible, he utilized the forms that nature gave his blocks of wood, though, as the specimens in his garden clearly showed, he was quite capable of dispensing with them. Grotesque as many of the carvings undoubtedly are, there's no denying that this self-taught sculptor is possessed of a good deal of real talent. At the top of the cliff overlooking the bay, he has erected a cross bearing a Christ that denotes considerable skill, and before leaving his house to visit the cliffs, he showed us some oak sideboards, tables, and chairs so beautifully carved that I had a difficulty in believing the work had been executed merely with a knife and a mallet. I'm inclined to think that these are the best of all of the Abbé Faure's productions. The carvings on the granite cliffs below his house are certainly less original than these admirable pieces of furniture, but though less artistic, they are much more curious from the point of view of the average traveler. It may be said, indeed, without any exaggeration, that they have made the reputation, both of Rutenhof and its hermit. Before his arrival, the village was unknown, almost without a visitor, and certainly without any other attraction than the rocky coast and the open sea. Now it is a recognized place of pilgrimage. A small tramway joins the Bourg to Paramé, and during the summer months, Thousands of tourists flock there to see the wonderful Rocher de Rutenouf. The idea of converting 100 yards of granite cliff into a huge sculpture gallery was, if I may be allowed to use an American expression, extremely cute.
Was that an American expression?
I didn't know that. So did it occur spontaneously to the Abbé Faure, or did he, presuming that he had been a traveler, borrow it from the carved rocks of Libichov in Bohemia? For the hermit had a predecessor some 80 years ago or so that lived in the person of the celebrated sculptor Václav Louet, who during his holidays at Libichov, where he had formerly been in the employ of the Comte Vif as a kitchen boy, carved the rocks in the neighboring forests. Fear of hurting the hermit's feelings by appearing to doubt his capacity for originality prevented me from asking if he had ever been there or heard of its famous carvings. The way to the rocks of Rutenouf leads from the top of the cliff. You pass on the way through a rustic entrance erected by the hermit, who has also placed in full view of visitors a box for their offerings, which he naively told us was devoted to the upkeep of the rocks. On the box are the following words: "It is neither amiable nor even just to visit these rocks without offering true compensation." And no one is ever inclined to quarrel with this reminder that something is due to the poor. All give freely after they have seen the result of his 10 years of patient toil. As you descend the steps which he has cut in the hard rock, you suddenly come upon one of the most extraordinary sights in France. On all sides are standing or reclining figures, some of them isolated, others in groups. The entire face of the cliff seems alive with saints, devils, and fantastic animals. Though you may not notice all at the first glance, you quickly discover that there is hardly a square yard of rock that has not been carved to resemble some human or animal form. The natural irregularity of the surface of the rocks has been utilized by the sculptor in a most clever manner. Here he has seen a suggestion for a head, there a long granite boulder that could be converted into a couchant saint with a long beard and a curious headdress, and there, again, a series of irregularly shaped rocks that wanted little change to them into a family group, that of a fisherman, his wife, and their 5 children, one of whom is lying on its mother's lap. You will notice, too, that a fish bearing a certain resemblance to a shark appears beneath the rock on which the fisherman is sitting, and that by the position of its snout it would seem to be able to devour the family. The religious element in the hermit's compositions is strong, as one would naturally expect. There are saints and angels innumerable, 2 or 3 altars, and at least 1 representation of the Almighty, but he has by no means limited himself to church and biblical subjects. Sometimes he has taken his inspiration from local history. One of his most ambitious compositions represents scenes in the lives of the lords of Rutenouf. Actuality, too, has often given him an idea for a group or single figure. For instance, at the time of the war and the death of the Colonel de Vibois-Moray, he set to work to compose a very lifelike sepulchral stature of that misguided hero. The realism of the hermit's pieces of sculpture is sometimes heightened by the addition of coats of paint. In this respect, he follows the example of some of the sculptors in the Middle Ages. His whole art, indeed, seems to be inspired by the work of these and other primitive artists. In the early years of the Abbé Faure's gigantic enterprise, and even up to quite recently, he could be seen every day, winter and summer alike, working hard with chisel and mallet. Now, owing to physical decline, he takes things a little easier, but whenever he's able to leave his house to continue his endless task, he does so. People laugh at him at first and make uncharitable remarks, but now that they know the old man better, they admire him for his simplicity, his goodness of heart, and his inexhaustible patience. Long may he continue to carve the rocks is a wish that not one of the inhabitants of the little village would gainsay.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That gave a very vivid impression of what it was like.
Yeah,
having not been there, I thought
the descriptions were.
They did a really good job.
Abbé Ferré continued carving the stone cliffs for 14 years. Not 14 years from that time, but from when he started. That article's from 1909. He died in 1910. They said he worked daily when he was able to do so throughout all seasons. You could find him out there working on the rocks. Eventually, his physical ailments forced him to stop altogether, and he died in the Hermitage at Routeneuf on February 10th, 1910. This is from the San Francisco Call, the 21st of March, 1910. Hermit of the Rock. Future visitors to Routeneuf will miss the venerable Abbé Ferré, who, like old mortality in some respects, struck out a peculiar line for himself. His mission, in time of recreation, was to chisel the high rocks of the coast, says London Globe. The old man was a picturesque figure, with his cassock, silver-buckled shoes, and white hair fluttering in the wind from beneath his beret. All his spare time was spent in carving figures of various kinds upon the rocks of granite. Here were to be seen fabulous monsters, animals, and portrayals of scenes from the Breton church history and legends, intermingled with heads of the leaders of the Boer War. In the season, the abbé was a personage of interest, and all visitors pleased themselves and him by inspecting his works of art. He had passed his 80th birthday and was known as the Hermit of the Rock. So his obituary made it
all the way to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, Jarvis Cocker will be out there looking for him, along with all the other outsider artists.
Before he died, Abbé Ferré would fill an area of almost 6,000 square feet with 300 stone sculptures.
That's a lot of feet.
That's pretty impressive.
It reminds me of so many of those other people who were like just never stopped working. Like the project was never done, whether it was the, is it the Winchester mansion or probably my favorite is the lady from Death Valley, whose name escapes me now, who had the opera house there.
Yeah, begin with an M, was it?
I can't think of her name.
She had painted the audience in the theater there. She would dance. Did she do like two or three shows a week when she was able to?
Yeah.
But she had painted an audience, so she'd always have an audience to
If no one came to visit.
Dance for. It's amazing.
She actually contacted me back in the days of MySpace because I had a picture of an old dancer from like the turn of the century as my image. Mm-hmm. And she wrote to me and she said, I have a book coming out soon. It's about my life. And there's going to be a movie, a documentary called, I think it's called To Dance on Sands.
Yeah.
It's like, I think you would like it.
It's a cool documentary.
It is. It's amazing. It's about this woman who leaves her very kind of normal life and kind of psychically ends up in Death Valley.
They went through there for some reason. She was on tour as a dancer, I think. And they went through there and she just said, I'm just staying.
I'm staying. Yeah.
And ends up buying the whole town, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, really interesting. The rocks at Routeneuf, the tourist board there does not actually advertise them. You can go there and see them.
Who owns the property?
I believe there's like a foundation or something
who
has taken over, but they're worried about erosion. Apparently, you know, it's right on the sea and the salt water and the wind and the sand have eroded the statues a good bit. And they're afraid if they really promote it. Before they want to make like pathways and stuff so people aren't just climbing all over the rocks.
They don't have
that yet. So they're afraid if they promote it too much before then, they're just going to get further degenerated by people touching them and everything else.
Yeah, but there's a sweetness to that. I mean, it reminds me of those sort of temporary mandalas where you get done the entire sand mandala and then you just wipe it away.
Yeah.
But it's all about the journey, right?
You can go. Apparently, it's expensive to tour the rocks, but for me, it would be very much worth it.
Yeah, I think so.
Someday, I would love to see those rocks.
We don't have any granite in the backyard. Otherwise, I know what Tim would be out there doing. Feel free, if you want to carve any of the the grass that's out there, maybe in a flat way, maybe once a week or so.
I tried to do an Edward Scissorhands with the hedges out front, but it didn't work.
Didn't work, no. It just looked like balls.
Maybe that's what I was going for. All of this would be interesting enough, but there may have been more to both Abbé Faure and his sculptures than just some carvings of saints, pirates, and devils. This article is from the Evening Star from Washington, D.C., the 10th of June, 1905. Good luck with this one.
The Future of France, Story of Old-Time Prophecy Carved in the Rocks. Where hermit priests sculptured fantastic figures, prediction made centuries and centuries ago has proved exact in the past, and things yet to come. Brittany, May 27th, 1905. When next you go to Atlantic City, cast your eyes northeast across the Atlantic. Far on the other side, where the first land begins, a rocky point of France sticks out into the ocean. Among these gigantic rocks, a modern hermit lives beside the tomb of one of the most ancient Celtic saints. The tomb is carved in rock, and all these rocks are carved fantastically in human shapes, and these carvings tell the story of an old-time prophecy that has proved exact in the past and promises strange things for France in the near future. The tomb is the tomb of Saint Budoc, who was a saint in the long past days when Irishmen and Bretons spoke one language, when the Celtic tongue was one of learning. More than 1,000 years have passed, and who Saint Budoc was is scarcely known. He left, however, two things: his carved rock tomb washed by the Atlantic breakers, and a mystically worded prophecy whose manuscript exists no longer, but whose text has been preserved in more than one occult book from the Middle Ages down. To these rocks, stretching out into the wild Atlantic as if pointing to the New World, came, some 20 years ago, a man who wished to live and meditate alone. He occupied a cave beside St. Budoc's tomb. He carved a sheltered seat from which to look on the immensity of sea and sky, and there he sat and brooded of the prophecy, or the prophecy of Orville, as you please to call it, because once, 400 years before him, such another solitary brooder, Philip Olivarius, a Cistercian monk, was struck in the same way by the same text, then already ancient, and its fulfillment in his time, and wrote a book upon it dated 1544. And as the modern hermit sat beside the tomb, meditating on the prophecy, it came to him that he ought to complete the rock carvings which the wind and waves had spared 1,000 years, and represent the prophecy pictorially on the spot where 1,000 years ago it was conceived. This is why tourists who have automobiles may now see a strange sight, meeting with an extraordinary personage, and hear a tale of prophecy fulfilled through centuries, and so feel a new thrill to wonder if the prophecy is now to stop short coming true. You come to Rutenough by any means you please except by train. It is a lost Breton village on the coast. You quit it and walk over windy downs where nothing grows but gorse and heather. Then you come to cliffs that overhang the ocean. Those you follow as they slope down to the shore to make a kind of pocket. You make one more turn and stand and wonder if you're not dreaming. Down carved steps, you wend your way into a kind of petrified inferno. Everywhere are human faces, human forms that sprawl or stand upright. The faces stare at you from overhanging cliffs, from the ground at your feet, from ledges that rise breast high. Seated figures sit immobile, staring at the sea. Groups of figures seem to have been petrified in action. All are carved in the eternal rock. What strikes one most is the archaic type to which they belong. The carvings look as if they've been there 1,000 years. Indeed, the hermit thinks they have, when in a communicative mood he may explain to you that he renewed the figures only, worn and washed by countless tides. You may believe this, or that the Atlantic simply washed the rocks into fantastic shapes, which stimulated the imagination of the hermit. In any case, the tomb itself is ancient. Backed up against the cliff, it looks half like an altar, half like a tomb, grotesquely decorated in the antique Celtic style. It is the tomb of St. Budoc, and the hermit sculptor doubtless took his inspiration from it. He, the hermit, has a modern look due to the fact that he is utterly sincere and utterly unconscious of the notice of stray tourists. He does not dress theatrically for the hermit's part. He looks what he was in earlier life, a county curé of the Breton race. His history is simple. 20 years ago, he was a parish priest. partial paralysis came suddenly and affected chiefly his speech. He was forced to give up his parish, so wandering he came to this wild shore which he knew from boyhood, and so he set up himself beside St. Budoc's tomb, with which he was so familiar as a Celtic student, and so he became a hermit. Thus the cult of St. Budoc and St. Budoc's prophecy grew upon this lonely man. Some say he has a Celtic text of the prophecy. If so, it's probably unique, because the oldest text known, itself extremely rare, is that of the monk Olivarius, the 16th century Cistercian. The hermit speaks little, first because of his infirmity, and secondly because of the hermit's life should be a silent one, but he shows innocent contentment when you express admiration for his handiwork. And now and then he will point to a figure or a group and tell its name, and sometimes he will even add the date to which it answers in the prophecy. To understand the meanings of all this, you must know something of the prophecy itself, which at various periods of French history has enjoyed immense celebrity and then become forgotten again. For example, shortly after the execution of Louis XVI, which it predicted, the emigrated French nobility in England, the Low Countries, and Austria gave great attention to it, naturally anxious for a sign. Again, about the year 1848, the accuracy with which it foretold the rise and fall of Louis Philippe became matter for general wonderment all over France. Indeed, Baron de Novailles, writing a couple of years ago, cited that part of its text foretelling the events between 1828 and 1849 as impossible to have been written by any but a sure enough prophet, vis-a-vis A, the fall of Charles X, B, that his successor should not call himself King of France, but King of the People, C, that the crown should be put on his head by working men who shall have combated in the great city of Paris, and D, that after 18 years of reign, the King of the People should be cast down. I ask the hermit to show us this part of the prophecy in his sculpted representation of it. The cock shall efface the white flower, he mumbled, quoting the text, and one shall call himself King of the People. He indicated a sprawling figure in stone with its foot on a fleur-de-lis. Louis Philippe, Monsieur, Monarchy of July, great commotion shall be felt because the crown shall be posed on his head by working men combating in the great city. The royalty of Louis Philippe came out of the riots of 1830. Of course, the text of the prophecy is too long to be quoted here, but reflect for a moment. 400 years ago, its accuracy in foretelling certain events so struck Philippe Olivarius that he published a book on it. Not to go back further than the French Revolution, it foretold Bonaparte and his victories in detail, his early campaigns in Malta and Egypt, the proclamation of the empire, conquests of the European crowns, apogee of the empire, concordat, even to the captivity of the Pope. Here is the part of the text. In that time, a young man, Napoleon, come to the Celtic land from beyond the sea, Corsica, will manifest himself by counsels of force. But the great ones, jealous, will send him to war in the island of captivity, Malta. But victory will bring him back to his first country, Italy. The sons of Brutus, Republicans, will become stupid at his approach because he will dominate them, Brumaire, and take the name of emperor. High and powerful kings will fear because the eagle, Bonaparte's emblem, will lift off many crowns. Foot soldiers and cavaliers bearing bloody eagles will go with him. All Europe will be overrun, and we will be so strong that God will seem to war on his side with him. The Church of God will be somewhat consoled and open again its temples to its wandering sheep. The old man of Sion cries to God from his captivity. Now the strong one, Napoleon, becomes blinded by passions and crimes. He quits the great city with so great an army as was never seen. But a third part of it, and still another third part of it, must perish by the cold of the Lord. Retreat from Moscow. Two lusters, 10 years, have passed since the cycle of desolation, the end of the revolution. Widows and orphans have cried, and God is not deaf. The high brought low will found a league, the first coalition, to put down the redoubted man. There comes with them the old blood of the centuries, old race of French kings, to retake its place in the great city, Paris, and the man will be abased and sent beyond the seas, to Elba. God only is great. The 11th moon has not yet passed. 11 times 28 days, 300 days, time of the first restoration. And the bloody whip of the Lord will be again laid out of the great city, and the old blood will quit the great city. The departure of Louis XVIII. God alone is great. The 5th moon, 3 times 28 days, the 100 days, shines on armies from the east. Gaul is covered with men and machines of war, and it is finished with the man of the sea, Napoleon. There's parts in quotes there. I don't know if that was apparent that when I kind of changed my voice there a little bit, they're talking about what fulfills the prophecy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I was stumbling, but it wasn't specifically because of that.
So much better than I would.
I'm quoting here from the text found in Henry Barres' Nostradamus, copied by Barres from a text dated 1822, itself copied from the text of Olivarius, published in Luxembourg in 1544. The hermit brought out of his pocket a much-worn number of a now-defunct magazine, the Journal de Vie et de Campagne, that's town and country.
Okay.
For June 1839, containing an installment of the prophecy, which ran on until August 1839, sections of the prophecy have also been published in Gaston Marais's Echo de Merveilleux, dated February 15th, 1904. Echo of the Marvelous, right? The hermit led us from one sculptured figure to another, from one sculptured tableau to another, muttering names and dates and the imagery of the old text. The old one of Sion, bloody eagles, sons of Brutus, he beckoned to me to look at his journal, his fingers indicating the lines, the prophecy after foretelling the Republic of 1848 foretells the rise of Louis Napoleon, the Franco-Prussian War, and the proclamation of the Third Republic under the cannon of the enemy. Howl, sons of Brutus, call down on yourselves the beasts which shall devour you, great God. What a noise of arms! The hermit read the words painfully. Behold the sons of Brutus, he chuckled, pointing to a sculptured group of villainous-looking citizens. The hermit is evidently not a good Republican. He led us further on. The future, he mumbled. The future. It's interesting because the paper that he gives them to read is from, what, June of 1839? He was born in 1839, right?
Mm, yeah.
He's born, like, a few months later.
Yeah.
First, we saw a lot of kneeling figures, evidently praying. Further, we were confused. Scenes of battle and arson. Then there was a gallant young shepherd with his flock, and further along were three other flocks of sheep. The text which these personify is that which follows directly after the apostrophe to the sons of Brutus proclaiming the Third Republic. It is done. The mountain of God, conservative and royalist cause, has called to God, and God is no longer deaf. 12 times 18 moons and 18 times 12 moons have nourished his wrath. Woe to thee, great city! Behold the kings armed by the Lord. The place of crime is purged by fire, and the great rivulet, the Seine, had run red to the sea. God loves peace. Come, young prince, quit the isle of captivity and join the lion to the white flower. Our eyes followed the hermit's fingers as he pointed it out line by line from the journal. The calculation is easy. 12 times 18 moons plus 18 times 12 moons makes 432 moons, or 36 years. You see how close France is to the ominous thing? Sons of Brutus, watch yourselves. The present French Republic dates from the year 1879. Add 36 years and you get the year 1906 with the prediction, woe to thee, great city. You understand, next year the kings, armed by the Lord, are to fall on Paris, and the Seine is to run red with blood to the sea. But who is the young prince, figured by the hermit as a shepherd, and what is the Isle of Captivity? Is it England, where Philippe of Orleans has Orleans House at Twickenham? He has also a great palace at Palermo in the island of Sicily. Joining the lion to the white flower evidently means adding Belgium to the old French monarchy. Monsieur is English? Insinuated the hermit. He pointed to a flock of stone sheep. English people, he explained. I understood when he pointed to the line of the text. Many lost sheep will come to drink at the living fountain. A great people of the sea will again take up the true faith in 2/3 parts. It is true that Ireland is already Catholic. God blesses the earth again during 14 times 6 moons and 6 times 13 moons. He will prolong peace even yet 10 times 12 moons. And then the man arrives, born of 2 races. That is the Antichrist. It is all there carved in the living rock. The Atlantic breakers pound upon the rocks below it. The hermit's cave is higher up in a dry spot, sheltered from the winds. Beside its entrance is his seat, carved in the rock to form a sheltering recess. There we left the hermit sitting alone and gazing on the western ocean as the sun set in a great red ball. God loves peace, he was muttering. Come, young prince, quit the Isle of Captivity. No, decidedly, the hermit of Rutenhof is not a good Republican.
So it's kind of hard to make your way through all that prophecy, but 1906, not much happened.
Yeah.
But World War I was right on the horizon.
Yeah.
very soon after.
I mean, the other part of me was the skeptic in me would say is there's hardly a time when any particular country hasn't been at war.
Yeah. That's
it's a pretty safe resume.
That's true, but it's very interesting because
yeah,
how close to Paris?
Yeah, add another decade and you're already in them. You think about what an integral part the French coast played in World War II.
I mean, World War I was, I don't know if the Seine ran red with blood, but, you know.
A lot of France did.
Brutal war. Be interesting for someone who really knows French history to look at those.
Yeah, maybe something more dramatic happened in 1906 I'm just not aware of.
Or maybe
the timing's just a little off.
Yeah,
maybe there's an extra moon there somewhere.
Yeah, things apply differently or something like that. Very interesting. May have been more than just folk art he was doing, according to that article.
Do you think every lone hermit monk is actually a secret occultist?
Not necessarily. No, I don't think that he was either. I think he may be a prophet, but that doesn't make him an occultist. So that's our story of Abbé Fauré. Incredibly fascinating person.
Certainly beats a lot of other ways to spend retirement.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that speaks to me because I would like to think that presented with whatever obstacles, I would continue to create.
Yeah.
Because it's very important to me. I love making things. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's, I love doing the podcast. It's just a different way of making things. You know, I love creating things. So it's a very inspiring story as far as that goes. One of our folk saints of the podcast, I think.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I'd love to go there and see.
Yeah, I absolutely love to go there.
Fun fact, you know, his birth is pretty much, you know, just within weeks of the announcement of photography, just in France.
Interesting. Interesting. And there are a ton of photographs of him taken as well. I have a lot of them. Puppies are cute, Allison.
Mm-hmm.
We all know this.
Yep.
But they can also be wild, crazy, whirlwinds of destruction, hurricanes of damage, windstorms of peeing on your carpet.
Tornadoes of terror.
Exactly.
Tornadoes of teething.
Tornadoes of teething. That's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. Tornadoes of teething. If you have a puppy, you want help with training.
Mm-hmm.
The best way to do it is to develop a relationship with your puppy. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you do that. They have a relationship-based approach to training that helps you and your puppy become perfect for each other. They have online sources like video lessons, a secret Facebook group, and of course, one-on-one options are available as well. You can find 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy at sithappens.us. Let them help you understand how your dog thinks and apply proactive training methods so you and your puppy can become perfect for each other. Whether it's issues with mouthing and biting, potty training, fear and nervousness, barking, chewing on furniture or shoes or other things they shouldn't be chewing on, if you need help with crate training, hyperactivity issues, leash training, and more, 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you. Again, you can find them at sithappens.us. Look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. You're going to like this curiosity of the week, Allison. It is extremely on point. I know you like a theme.
I do like a theme. We hardly ever have any Bigfoot photos.
Yeah. And those I do have, I'm not selling. These are real photo postcards of Abbé Fauré. In the one has, and you'll see what I mean, this does not look like a hut. That's his place. That's the wall with the heads upon the battlement you can see behind him there that they were talking about in the article.
Do other people live here? It looks like a compound.
It looks massive, right?
Yeah.
Well, maybe his place is just off to the side of that.
Yeah.
It's hard to call that a hut, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that you can see the heads
on the
battlement that they were talking about.
And then he's just standing there near the door. Wonder if they gave him a penny for these photos. Probably not.
Who knows? And this other photo is of Abbé Fauré actually carving the rocks on the cliffs.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Tell you what, you wouldn't think like a long flowing
cassock
would be the perfect. It looks to have an apron over top of him.
Probable, I would think.
And he's just out there sitting on one rock to pretty up another. You know, nowadays you never get away with, like, actually making something magical out of nature.
Just going out and doing that.
Yeah.
I think people would come.
Someone would find a reason to just sandblast it out of spite.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. That's not yours.
Yeah. Oh, man. These photos are awesome. Like I said, they're, I don't know how many photos they took of him. I have a lot of them.
It must have been close enough to some major cities that it made it worthwhile to go out and...
I don't know. He was certainly a figure of curiosity. If you go to the show notes, you can see these images, which people might find interesting because they are of Abbé Fauré. But if you click on those, it'll take you to our Etsy shop, and you can actually buy these two real photo postcards from us. If you purchase stuff from our Etsy shop, it helps the show, helps us continue making Strange Familiars. Also in our Etsy shop will be a watercolor portrait I did of Abbé Fauré.
Aw, there he is, carving.
Holding his hammer and chisel.
Oh, and there's a sort of a figure just barely being able to be seen on the...
In the stones behind
him. Yeah, ghostly stone figure. Just waiting to be... What was the word that he used? To just bring out the detail of what was already there so everyone else could see it.
Yeah. So that will be in our Etsy shop as well. I also added a whole bunch of other original artwork. I added even more. I know I said I added some last week. I added even more over the weekend. Original art from Where the Footprints End, original art from The Witch Cloud, and some more besides. If you want to own a part of Where the Footprints End, Volume 1 or Volume 2, here's your chance to do so. If you want to own a part of The Witch Cloud, here's your chance to do so. There's other original art I added as well. Of course, I have prints of my artwork there. Strange Familiars t-shirts, the classic Awoken Tree design, and we still have some of the High Strangeness tour shirts left. We're getting kind of thin on those, so hurry up and get one if you want one. My books are at Etsy. Some of my music is there. Allison has added lots and lots of antique photographs there and much more. Go ahead and check it out. Our shop name is Lost Grave, but if you're on Etsy and you type in Strange Familiars, you should see our stuff come up. While you're at Etsy, make sure to check out our friends at Karmic Garden. Oh, they sent us some stuff this week.
Yeah.
Kind of doing the Strange Familiars soap in a kind of new format. That's like kind of marbleized. Looks really cool. Like blue and black marbleized. And they sent us some nice smelling sprays.
I mean, it's that time of year when you kind of want to smell like something other than...
You can get all that kind of stuff, sprays and candles and all that kind of stuff there at Karmic Garden. You can check them out on Etsy as well. And Chad is on Etsy with his shop, Ruck Rabbit Outdoors. He's got all kinds of woodsman-y stuff and flannel and hatchets and knives. And his stock changes a lot because they have a lot of one-of-a-kind.
Yeah, they do items. A lot of one-of-a-kind vintage stuff.
Go ahead and check him out while you're there. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back soon with more Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, music, books, art, podcasts, and more. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. If you want to hear more or purchase music by Stone Breath, you can go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com. Strange Familiars is on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. Also on Facebook, you can join the Strange Familiars gathering group, interact with other listeners. We share some stories about paranormal stuff there and updates on the show and everything else. And you can find us on the web at strangefamiliars.com. We also have a Discord for our patrons. If you're a patron, that's another perk you get. You get to be on our Discord. If you're a patron and you want to be on our Discord, just shoot me a message through Patreon and I can get you the link for Discord.
It isn't all just Tim playing Minecraft.
It isn't. I barely play Minecraft at all on there. I don't. I like Minecraft.
Like, isn't that what Discord was really for? To watch people like interact.
I like Minecraft, but I haven't played it in years. Oh, I also wanted to mention that our patrons are now also getting almost ad-free versions of the show on Patreon. So the regular shows, the weekly shows, mm-hmm. We drop them, you know, through the regular feed, and we put them up on Patreon. They still have the 90 days commercial on it because they're kind of baked into the show. But if you don't like the ads, really, you can just skip through them. But if you don't like hitting that skip button, now on Patreon, you can get an almost ad-free version of the show. It's always going to have that 90 days ad in there because it is what it is.
It's pretty much just part of the show.
Yeah. Otherwise, another benefit for patrons. That's patreon.com/strangefamiliars.
I saw your face in the bubbling stream. Would I see your eyes, love streaked in the sky?
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.